Southern Fried True Crime covers cases that are not suitable for young listeners. Today's episode contains extremely sexually explicit topics and language. Listener discretion is strongly advised. The pink triangle is a symbol of power and pride for the LGBTQ community, but it was once a source of pain and tragedy. An inverted pink triangle was sewn onto the shirts of gay men in Nazi concentration camps. The pink triangle was reclaimed as an empowering symbol, but also as a reminder of the prejudice the LGBTQ community still faces. Since the 90s, signs with a pink triangle in a green circle have signified safe spaces for queer people, which is painfully ironic for today's case. Louisville locals in the press dubbed the murder of Jamie Carroll the Pink Triangle Murder. Jamie was a gay man and often performed as a drag queen. When he was murdered, he was in Old Louisville, a place welcoming to the queer community, somewhere that a vulnerable man like Jamie would feel safe. He was killed in the home of two other gay men. Again, we have a case of what some would call a love triangle, and the ensuing trials would be called a case of he said, he said. Which man really killed Jamie Carroll? What we know for sure is that Jamie was murdered in a historic Victorian mansion in Old Louisville, a house with a dark history, before two men buried their dark secret in the basement. Old Louisville is a gorgeous historic district. It's America's oldest Victorian neighborhood, and it's most haunted. Welcome to episode 132, Old Louisville's Pink Triangle Murder. It was a rainy night on June 17th, 2010, when a 911 operator in Louisville, Kentucky, answered a call from a hysterical-sounding man. He said, "I'm at 1435 South 4th Street. My ex-boyfriend is in my house. Please come immediately." He said, "He's trying to get into the room where I'm hiding. The door is locked, but I can hear the wood breaking. I'm scared. He's crazy." After getting the man's name, which was Jeffrey Munt, the operator asked who was attacking his door, and Munt said, "Joey Bannis. Please hurry." He told the operator that Bannis was trying to break down the bedroom door with a hammer and that he had a knife. Jeffrey Munt appeared to be genuinely sobbing as he begged for help and begged for the police to hurry. Two officers responded, Christopher Pettigo and Trey McKnight. They walked around Munt's house, then pried a side door open and made their way inside. Joseph Bannis came running down the stairs. Police pointed their guns at him and told him to lay on the ground. Jeffrey Munt was found hiding in the second floor front bedroom, as he had told the 911 dispatcher. Joseph Bannis and Jeffrey Munt were then separated for questioning. Munt was questioned upstairs by Officer Pettigo, while Bannis was questioned downstairs by Officer McKnight. McKnight searched Joey Bannis and his backpack. He did not have a knife on him. In his backpack, McKnight found drug paraphernalia, pipes, hollow cigarettes, syringes, but no drugs, only residue. Just based on the paraphernalia, Joey Bannis was placed under arrest and put in the back of McKnight's cruiser. Under questioning by Officer McKnight, Joey Bannis tried offering up information on drug dealers, but McKnight wasn't interested. He was asking him about the alleged attempted attack on his boyfriend, Jeffrey Munt. So Joey suddenly switched tactics and said he wanted to speak to the homicide unit about a body in the basement. Officer McKnight didn't really believe Bannis. None of the other officers did until later that day. Meanwhile, Officer Pettigo asked Jeffrey Munt, who was not injured, the regular series of questions when responding to a domestic dispute. Like, was it a fight over money? Was alcohol involved? Etc. Jeffrey said, "Well, you need to ask him about the body in the basement." According to Officer Christopher Pettigo, the statement came from left field. Pettigo then walked down to his partner, Officer Trey McKnight, who was at his patrol car with Joey Bannis in the back seat. Pettigo told McKnight what Jeffrey Munt said about there being a body in the basement. McKnight was a bit shocked. He said, "Well, he said the same thing about a body." Pettigo started talking to Joey Bannis. He read him his Miranda rights, then casually asked about the basement. "Hey man, What's this I hear about a body in the basement? Joey then said, I don't have shit to say to you about that. Officer Pettigo realized this was going to turn into something more than a domestic case. He called the homicide department in. Joey Bannis was taken to the station for questioning, while Jeffrey Munt stayed at the house. The house at 1435 South 4th Street is a beautiful, though at the time crumbling, mansion that sits just behind Millionaire's Row in Old Louisville. It's known as the Richard Robinson House. I would like to go ahead and thank author David Domine before I go any further. He contacted me and asked if I would like to do an episode on this case to help promote his new book, A Dark Room in Glitterball City, Murder, Secrets, and Scandal in Old Louisville. He not only sent me a copy of the book with full permission to use as my main source, but he shared his voluminous trial notes. As usual, my researcher, Haley Gray, combed through what court documents and articles she could find, as well as all of David's notes. Haley helped keep the facts of this story straight, while I got to enjoy David's incredible book and lose myself in Old Louisville. It is the largest Victorian neighborhood in the country, the third largest historic district, and as many people say, the most haunted neighborhood in America. Gargoyles peer at you from atop the massive and sometimes brightly colored brick homes, with ornate Queen Anne, Italianate, and Romanesque style architecture. The mansions are shaded by huge trees, as old or older than the houses themselves. Stained glass glints through the shadows everywhere you look. Old Louisville has the largest collection of pedestrian-only streets in America, too. There are 11 courts, where mansions face each other across a grass median with sidewalks, and most of these courts are centered off of 4th Street, where the Richard Robinson Mansion sits. Gas lights, the old street lamps, not the psychological abuse, still light your way through these magnificent courtyards. David Domine, also a professor and walking tour guide in Old Louisville, along with being an author, once looked at the Richard Robinson House to possibly buy and renovate, about a year before Jamie Carroll's murder. That's the house at 1435 South 4th Street. It was built in 1897. He writes that the 9,000-square-foot, 12-room mansion was dark and foreboding. It was already in great disrepair when David and his partner Ramon looked at the house. As he noted, the ornate banister and original moldings, he also saw broken window panes and crumbling plaster on the ceilings. The bedroom doors had old tarnished brass numbers dating back to the mansion's time as a boarding house. He also ruefully noted an old cardboard box of porn magazines left carelessly in a corner. Even though he knew the kitchen would have to be completely torn out, and this house would be too much work to take on, he and Ramon ventured on to look in the carriage house anyway, where he noticed the second disco ball or glitter ball in the home. Also called mirror balls, they were first used in nightclubs in the 1920s. Of course, many of us associate them with discotheques of the 1970s, but they've been around for a while and called many things over the years. Omega National Products in Louisville is said to have made 90% of disco balls used in the U.S. during the disco craze. And now, they are one of the last companies that still produce them. Like David, I prefer the term glitter ball. I have a collection of tiny glitter balls that my mother started for me that covers my Christmas tree every year. The tiny mirrors reflect off the lights and make the tree glow even more. The glitter ball David saw in the carriage house of the Robinson Mansion lay in a corner. The back alley of the house faces the Samuel Culbertson Mansion, which is now a bed and breakfast. Culbertson was the fifth president of Churchill Downs and presided over the board until 1947. He began the tradition of the garland of roses placed on the Kentucky Derby winner. The first champion, adorned with the design he commissioned, was Burgoo King in 1932. All of this history and opulence lies directly behind what is infamously called the Murder House, the beautiful old Victorian mansion where Jamie Carroll was murdered and buried. The house was said to be haunted before the scandalous murder of 2010 occurred. In the early 1900s, a doctor turned 1435 South 4th into a sanatorium, where supposedly the curse began, with several patients dying under his care during the 20s and 30s. An angel of death, people whisper. Then a nurse bought the mansion in the 60s, turning it into a boarding house. She supposedly housed drug addicts and sex workers before being beaten to death by one of her tenants. And it was rumored that there had been satanic rituals in the basement, and also a sex club, an S&M club in that small dark room where Jamie's body was buried. There were no shortage of rumors about the old Robinson house, not the least of which is that it's haunted. It was in the 1960s that activists sought to reform old Louisville, buying and restoring many of the beautiful mansions and Victorian cottages, though not the one at 1435 South 4th Street. Old Louisville has been a haven for colorful, eccentric people ever since, with a free, artistic, bohemian feel. Coffee shops, bars, cafes, and four-star restaurants dot the neighborhood, as do gay bars and chic nightclubs featuring famous drag queens. But the unhoused, panhandlers, drug dealers, and sex workers also walk the streets of Old Louisville. It is still considered a rough neighborhood by many. Evidently, there is a lot of infighting in the neighborhood as well between old money and the nouveau riche. And this murder scandal at the Robinson House, as one local complained, really put a damper on the 2010 Pride celebrations. A lot of the old homes have been turned into apartments. As one snotty elite on the Louisville City Council once said, let the students and homos live there. Jamie Carroll's murder shook the neighborhood. While there was crime and the occasional murder, this one was especially scandalous and creepy. After all, his body was found in the wine cellar of what was considered a haunted old mansion. And it gave more, quote, ammunition to the East End housewives, as one local in Domine's book said. Fuck 'em, let 'em stay out in their McMansions. So it would seem the feeling is mutual between locals and those in the more elite neighborhoods who just like to visit old Louisville for its charm and culture before retreating back to their sleek, contemporary homes with modern alarm systems. It's somehow poetic that the first bit of gossip David Domine overheard about Jamie Carroll's murder was between two drag queens. Domine had just spent the day with Boz Luhrmann, who was scouting locations for his new dazzling iteration of The Great Gatsby. He wanted a feel for where old money like Daisy grew up. He took Luhrmann to a party at the Gilmer Speed residence, where classic mint juleps were served in frosted glasses as they heard about the Gilded Age of Louisville, including F. Scott Fitzgerald's stay there, which is said to have inspired his most famous novel. As Domine worked his way through the crowd, he heard someone say, "What do you think, Mr. Author?" Two drag queens were joking about making a historical Edwardian drag queen book, but realized who he was. One said, "You can write a whole book about the messes drag queens get themselves into," which quickly turned into gossip about the murder at 1435 South 4th, and the two freaks, as they called them, who buried a man in the wine cellar. One excitedly identified the victim as Jamie Carroll, a gay man from Lexington, who was a hairdresser, but also provided party favors, as she called them. She didn't know Jamie's last name, but she knew he was called Little Jamie for his small stature. What she didn't evidently know was that Jamie Carroll also performed in drag. But fittingly, it was the bartender who knew the details, which he spilled as he poured the ultimate mint julep made with Old Forester Kentucky bourbon. He debunked the myth that Jamie Carroll's body had been hacked up before it was buried. It was found in a huge Rubbermaid plastic storage bin. He explained that the men had to fold Jamie's body to make it fit in, and broke his knees with a sledgehammer to fit him inside his tomb. I'm going to pause now for a short commercial break. Jamie Carroll was 37 years old when he was brutally murdered in that house in Old Louisville. Some say he had come to Louisville for a fresh start, and that he particularly loved old Louisville and the beautiful houses there. He was originally from eastern Kentucky in the Martin-Prestonburg area. He graduated from high school in Allen City, and after that he moved to Lexington, where he opened his own hair salon. At the trials for his murder, he is often lost in the scandal of kinky sex and drugs. He was called a drug dealer, and he was one, but that's not all he was. Plenty of people remember him as a really sweet man, or a sweet kid, as he was often called. You get the feeling it was because he was small. He was 5'7" and weighed less than 130 pounds. He was an accomplished drag queen, quite beautiful in his makeup, a great singer, and was considered vivacious in his performances. He won Miss Gay Pride West Virginia a couple of years before his murder. His stage name was Ronica Reed, the pageant queen. David Domine was surprised to find out that his stage persona was based on a high school friend of his. He asked her if she minded, and she said, of course not. Drag queens usually impersonate famous people, so she was really flattered. Her real name was Ronica Reed, and she was gorgeous and into beauty pageants. She had won the Miss Kentucky Teen World pageant. She was good friends with Jamie in high school, even though she was much younger. She said she looked up to him. She remembered him as sweet and confident and openly gay in high school, which is kind of shocking for a small town where everyone knew each other. But Ronica said Jamie was popular and never bullied, and she fondly remembered the tight jeans and cowboy boots he would strut around in. He had the best walk of any man I know, she said. One former friend painted a tougher picture of Jamie's upbringing, talking about domestic violence in his family, money problems, and addiction. She said, quote, "He didn't have it smooth, growing up gay with all those hicks in the hills." And other friends remembered how talented he was on stage, and the complete transformation. He would be this gorgeous queen in sky-high heels, and then change out of his costume, and would be just as handsome. He was fit, with toned arms, and a beautiful smile. When he was remembered negatively, it had to do with drugs. So Jamie Carroll could be a contradiction. One friend remembering a tough childhood, and another remembering a popular, happy guy in high school. He was a warm and caring friend, but also a drug dealer. And drugs, particularly meth, can really change your personality. But as one of the many colorful people in David's book said, quote, "I don't care if he was a drug dealer or had a criminal past. He had hopes, and this neighborhood killed him. Old Louisville is a fair but fickle mistress." And maybe most importantly, Jamie was not at all like the men who killed him. Both Jeffrey Munt and Joey Banas came from good families and grew up privileged. They were both around Jamie's age. Jeffrey and Joey were both born in February of 72, so they were 38 at the time of the murder. Jeffrey was from a rich Louisville family, a governor's scholar in high school who got a full ride to college, where he pledged Phi Beta Kappa and graduated with a BA in computer science. He went on to work as a computer consultant in Washington, D.C., and then moved to Chicago when he got a job at Northwestern University. Then he got a job at the University of Louisville, and he bought the house at 1435 South 4th when he was with his then longtime boyfriend. But the boyfriend dumped Jeffrey via text, and he was devastated. They were going to make the house a bed and breakfast. But by the time Joey Banas moved in, only Jeffrey's room was renovated, and he was into hard drugs. Joey Banas was from Falls Church, Virginia, the son of a prominent plastic surgeon. He had lived in Hawaii and California before Louisville. He was a hippie who followed the Grateful Dead before he became comfortable with his sexuality. He evolved into a raver and then got into the nightclub business. He either owned or was part owner in his own nightclub in downtown Louisville. This all sounds laid back and even ambitious, but Joey had been racking up felonies since 1994. He was charged with trafficking meth several times and once for assaulting an EMT. He spent a year in prison for being a repeat trafficking offender. Sentenced to 5 years, but out in one, as the system goes. So on paper, Joey Bennis seems like the bad guy in this relationship. Multiple felonies, violent, a drug dealer. Supposedly, Jeffrey Munt had never even had a speeding ticket before he met Joey. Joey met Jamie Carroll first, before Jeffrey, in September or October of 2009. They met on a dating website. At trial, his attorneys painted the relationship as two peas in a pod. They said Jamie made Joey feel special, and although they were lovers, they weren't exclusive. But Jamie did become Joey's meth dealer also. Then Joey and Jeffrey met on a dating site in November of 2009. They got serious pretty quickly. Or Joey glommed on and moved in quickly, because he said Jeffrey told him to quit speaking to Jamie, and he refused, saying he didn't want to settle down and be monogamous. He said that Jeffrey was jealous of Jamie Carroll. Before the domestic violence call in June of 2010, when they both confessed to a body being buried in the basement, the two men visited Chicago in April. They were caught trying to pass a counterfeit bill at the Hyatt Regency. When the officer busted them, Joey had a fully loaded Glock in his pocket. The doorman of the hotel identified Jeffrey as the man who gave him fake $100 bills. So they were arrested and separated, taken with their luggage to the police station. At the station, Joey Bennis confessed and took all the blame. He said there was $54,000 in counterfeit money in the bags, and there was. The cops also found two more guns registered to Jeffrey Munt. There was also ammo and magazines, computers, credit card decoders and readers, an Indiana ID that didn't belong to Joey Bennis, and a fake Washington ID. The counterfeit money was seized by the Secret Service, and still, both men were released on bail and allowed to return to Louisville. I'm going to pause now to hear a word from today's sponsors. Today's episode is brought to you by BetterHelp. Like many people, I suffer from depression and anxiety. I've been on medication for years, but medication isn't the only solution. I still have to talk to someone, and it's hard for me when I'm always on deadline. Is there something making it hard for you too? BetterHelp Online Counseling is there for us. They will assess your needs and match you with your own licensed professional therapist. It's not a crisis line. It's not self-help. It is professional counseling done securely online. From your phone, laptop, or tablet, you can start communicating with your counselor in under 48 hours. And BetterHelp fits your comfort level, so you can text or chat if you would rather not talk on the phone or video. You can send a message to your BetterHelp counselor at any time, and anything you share is confidential. BetterHelp has over 3,000 licensed therapists in all 50 states treating depression, anxiety, stress, trauma, grief, and other issues that so many of us suffer from. BetterHelp is more affordable than traditional offline counseling, and financial aid is available. I want you to start living a happier life today. As a listener, you'll get 10% off your first month by visiting betterhelp.com/southern. Join over 1 million people taking charge of their mental health. Again, that's BetterHelp, help.com/southern. Today's episode is also brought to you by Olive and June, the amazing at-home nail salon. I love having a great manicure, and I like to try out different colors all the time, but I don't always have time to go to a nail salon. I like to do my own nails while I'm relaxing, watching TV, but they've never looked salon quality until now. I got the Olive and June Studio Box, which comes with everything you need, including this cool accessory called the Poppy. You attach it to a brush to stabilize your hand. So now my right hand doesn't look like a five-year-old painted it. It comes with 13 different colors to try, all of which are hot shades right now, from nude to a deep midnight blue. The polish is also durable. It does not chip and lasts for a week or longer. I suggest starting with the Olive and June Mani system with 6 polishes. It breaks down to about $2 a mani, and I used to spend over $40 for one gel mani. Getting beautiful, salon-perfect nails at home is now a dream come true with Olive and June. Your new nail life is here. Visit oliveandjune.com/southernfried and use code southernfried for 20% off your first Manny system. This is an exclusive offer you can only get here. That's oliveandjune.com/southernfried. Code southernfried for 20% off your first Manny system. oliveandjune.com/southernfried, code southernfried. At the station, Joey Bannis told Detective John Lesher that the body buried in the old wine cellar was Jamie Carroll, and no one would have reported him missing because he was supposed to have gone to prison the day he died. Joey said he wanted to make a deal. Basically, he said, "I give you this information, you let me go home. I tell you about this body, you let me out of here." Joey told the police that the initial plan was for him and Jeffrey Munt to rob Jamie Carroll of his meth and cash that he had on him before he went to prison. Detective Lesher put James Carroll's name in a database. He found two outstanding bench warrants, one in Louisville, the other in Lexington, all from mid-December 2009. He found his mugshot and a photo from a dating site. Joey identified Jamie from the pictures. He checked prisons to make sure Jamie wasn't actually incarcerated and found three different Lexington addresses. He finally found a number for Jamie's mother who said, "You're not going to find him. He's in prison." I've seen Jamie's mother in later interviews, and she was understandably devastated and haunted by what happened to her son. It makes you wonder what had made them so estranged that she didn't try to communicate with her son while she thought he was in prison. Now Detective Lesher believed Joey Bannis. He went back to talk to him again. Joey said that he knew Jamie through the drug scene and that he was a dealer. He said that he had only recently met his boyfriend, Jamie Munt, but that he liked meth too. The two men had invited Jamie to the house on 4th Street, and then they sent Jamie back to his motel room to get more meth at around 5 or 6 a.m. He said it was Jeffrey's idea to get Jamie back there with more drugs so they could take them from him. He said Jeffrey said, quote, "It sure would be nice not to have to spend money on crystal." Joey said, quote, "I really thought he was joking or pushing my buttons to see where I stood on this whole thing." Lesher asked what time of year this was, and Joey told him it was the end of November or early December of 2009, and that he could verify that by the date of Jamie's last court date. He said Jamie returned with what he thought was several ounces of meth, and they all got high. He said Jamie and Jace, as he sometimes called Jeffrey, were in the bed as he sat nearby watching porn on the television. Then he said, quote, "I didn't know either of them that well. My boyfriend I had fallen in love with, Jamie, and I had never really seen that in a social environment. So they're in bed, naked, and I was basically getting high and watching porn. And before I knew it, he had stabbed Jamie. Jamie jumped up, there was blood flying, and there was a lot of yelling." Lesher asked if he knew where Jeffrey stabbed Jamie, and Joey said somewhere around the upper neck or torso. He said he was in shock, hyperventilating against a wall, as Jamie screamed for help and Jeffrey pulled out a revolver and shot him. Joey said, "I thought at that point he was going to kill me." His voice then shook as he recalled a grisly scene where Jamie Carroll was gushing blood all over the floor and walls. He said Jamie had fallen through a glass cabinet because there was also broken glass everywhere. And then he said, quote, "Helping Jeff clean this up was a pretty traumatic experience." He explained that Jeffrey wrapped Jamie in bed linens and they pulled him out into the hallway. "Jace acted like he had done this before," he said. He said Jeffrey took Jamie's cell phone and pulled out the SIM card and destroyed it. He also said Jeffrey took Jamie's laptop and removed internet access, making it anonymous. I guess it means he wiped the laptop, which would make sense. Jeffrey was in IT, a computer expert. Lesher asked him who dug the hole, and Joey said, quote, "He said that I would get my ass down there and help him, or else I'd be going into that hole." When Lesher asked about the laptop, Joey said it was one of the computers seized in Chicago, that Jeffrey used it for scams and modifications for the counterfeit bills. He also said the gun Jeffrey used to shoot Jamie had been confiscated in Chicago. Lesher confirmed these statements with the Chicago police. When Detective Lesher asked him why he came forward, Joey basically said he had been too scared before, but he wanted to clear his conscience of, quote, what I've done or not done, and said he wanted to be free of Jeffrey, who he claimed basically held him prisoner over the last months after Jamie's murder. He said the night Jeffrey killed Jamie, he was acting maniacal and carrying around a gun. Lesher asked, do you know of any other murders this guy's done? Bannis said, just stuff that he's told me in the past he has supposedly done for the U.S. government. He said that Jeffrey told him he had killed 35 people through his work with the government. But he insisted, quote, all I know is he scares the hell out of me. This is the only thing I've witnessed, the only thing I can attest to. He then explained to the detective that Jeffrey was jealous of Jamie, although they had all had sexual relationships at some point. He then drew a map of the basement so investigators could find Jamie's body. Detective Lesher would later describe Joey Bannis as articulate but tired. Meanwhile, back at the house, another detective questioned Jeffrey Munt. When he was told that Joey Bannis said there was a body in the basement, King said Munt acted shocked and horrified. He said he asked Jeffrey to come down to the station to talk some more, and Jeffrey said sure. At first, he said that he had tried to break up with Joey, and that Joey threatened to kill him and frame him for murder. He was the one who called 911 after all. As Jeffrey is being questioned, Detective Lesher and two other officers return to the house and search the basement or the old wine cellar. They found a spot that looked like a fresh pile of dirt. So the officers began digging until they hit something solid. They pulled out a blue 50-gallon Rubbermaid container, and as the officers began lifting the lid, they smelled the unmistakable smell of death and put the lid back, and called in the coroner. The box was taken to the medical examiner's office. Inside was Jamie Carroll's partially decomposed body. The ME determined Carroll had been shot in the back of the neck and suffered multiple stab wounds, three of which were fatal. The container weighed 270 pounds in total. Carroll himself weighed 128 pounds and was 5'7". Jamie was in a crouched position, hogtied with twine, and the ME noted that his body was concretized in the container. Jamie's head was cradled in his left arm. He was shot with a .38 caliber in the back of the neck. The bullet was still in his chin. There were six stab wounds found, but Jamie's throat was not slit, which will be important in a bit. There were three downward stab wounds that damaged Jamie's brachiocephalic artery, causing hemorrhaging. This was the cause of death. And he would not have died instantly. He would have bled out for several minutes. There were injuries and lacerations to Jamie's knees, foot, and elbow. And a toxicology report showed meth and alcohol in Jamie's blood. On Jamie's body, Dr. Stewart found a metal bracelet, a watch, a silver cross necklace, two rings, and two, quote, sexual-type devices, a penile ring, and a penile scrotal harness. There was also the twine used to hogtie him and duct tape. Lesher went back to the station, where Jeffrey Munt denied having any knowledge. At one point, he asked, can you tell me if there's someone buried in my house? A detective said, there is. Then he feigned surprise by putting his hand over his face and started crying, oh my God. He was shown pictures of Jamie and he said, quote, he doesn't even look remotely familiar. Jeffrey kept referring to Jamie as the guy, but at one point, he slipped up and said the name Jamie. When officers asked him how he knew the name Jamie, Jeffrey said the photo had the name James Carroll written on it, which was not true. Jeffrey told police about his relationship with Joey Bannis. He said Joey was a drug dealer who was well known. He sold LSD and followed the Grateful Dead around. Jeffrey said Joey's parents told him about Joey's problems and were, quote, hoping he was going straight. But after the Chicago arrests, Joey's parents didn't speak to him. Jeffrey also weirdly complained that Joey had expensive taste, quote, he had to have the best of the best. He said Joey was entitled and ungrateful. Jeffrey said Joey often had schemes to rob people. He even had a plan to rob and kill a man named Brian, who Joey felt stole his club from him. Jeffrey said Joey told him he robbed a bank and that it was easy to do. Jeffrey said Joey would lie to people by saying Jeffrey worked for the NSA, CIA, etc. Officers felt like Jeffrey Munt was lying to them, so they asked him if he would take a polygraph, and he said yes. As they prepped Jeffrey for the polygraph, he decided to tell the police what happened. Later, according to the prosecution, the story that he tells mirrors the story that they've been hearing from Joey, except the roles were different. Jeffrey said Joey threatened him if he didn't stay quiet. As Jeffrey Munt was being taken into custody, officers looked in his wallet and found 3 counterfeit bills. He also had a key ring with a knife on it. Both men did agree on what happened after the murder. They cleaned up the blood, which there was a lot of. Then they went to the hardware store and purchased a blue 50-gallon Rubbermaid container along with lime, duct tape, and foam sealant. Back at the house, they noticed that rigor mortis had set in. They couldn't just put him in the container like they had thought. So they hogtied him, then used a sledgehammer to break his knees, and then they wedged him inside the container. Next, they poured lime all over Jamie's body, then put the lid on the container and sealed it with foam sealant. Then they took duct tape and wrapped it around the container in hopes of keeping the smell from escaping. Next, they spent hours digging a hole with a pick and shovel, which ended up being 5 feet deep and 5 feet wide. They put the container in the hole, then filled the hole back up with dirt. On June 18th, the crime scene unit processed the house. In the basement, technicians found 2 shovels, a sledgehammer, and spent casings. The next week, Lesher went to Chicago and located the items that were confiscated from Jeffrey Munt and Joey Banas. The guns were tested, and the .38 was found to be the same gun used to kill Jamie Carroll. This was the last piece of evidence needed to indict Munt and Banas. On June 22nd, both men were indicted for complicity to murder, complicity to first-degree robbery, and tampering with evidence. On October 19th, 2011, after spending 18 months in jail, Jeffrey Munt was released on a $500,000 bond. Joseph Banas remained in jail, his bond higher due to his record. The police later found out that Jeffrey had hired a contractor to cover the basement in concrete. I'm going to pause now to hear a final word from today's sponsors. I know I've got Southern Fried listeners who love Best Fiends as much as I do. It's my brain break to play in my downtime. Best Fiends is way more fun than other Match 3 style puzzle games. I swear, 30 minutes go by like 30 seconds. In Best Fiends, you play through an actual storyline. The good guys are your fiends and the bad guys are slugs. The more you play, the more fiends join your team, and the more powerful they become, helping you solve increasingly challenging puzzles as you progress through the game. I recently collected a fiend named Cece with the cutest background. Cece used to be shy, but thanks to her fiends, she is living her musical dreams. With Best Fiends, the adorable collectible characters just keep coming. And Best Fiends releases new challenges, characters, and themes all the time to keep you engaged and on your toes. I'm almost finished with a challenge that when I complete 30 tasks, I get an epic fiend named Birthday Howie. I'm now on level 1657, which is cool because Best Fiends has literally thousands of levels with more added all the time. There is so much to love about this game. Once you start, Best Fiends is hard to put down for puzzle fanatics like me. Download Best Fiends free today on the App Store or Google Play. That's friends without the R, Best Fiends. I'm obsessed with sunglasses. Some women love shoes. I love my shades. And today's sponsor, Blenders, is about to make my collection a lot cooler and more affordable. Chase Fisher started Blenders by selling his beachy shades out of a backpack while doubling as a surf instructor on Pacific Beach. His goal was to create an adventurous mid-priced eyewear option with the same cool factor as other leading styles. Blenders' team of in-house designers are constantly coming out with new styles, from orange polarized wraparounds, tortoiseshell frames with purple lenses to classic gold arms on black lenses. And they offer prescription glasses, readers, and blue lights. I chose a classic pair of Nina Davina style shades in tortoiseshell with smoky lenses that will go great with a dressy outfit. I can't quit looking at their website. There are just so many cool styles to choose from. Unlike expensive big brand shades that I always tend to lose, blenders are actually affordable, so I can try two cute styles and not cry when the inevitable happens. To score 15% off your blender's purchase, visit blenderseyewear.com and enter promo code SOUTHERNFRIEDVIP. That's blenderseyewear.com, code SOUTHERNFRIEDVIP for 15% off. Blenders, rocked with pride worldwide. Joey Banas and Jeffrey Munt were tried separately, and Joey went on trial first. In exchange for the prosecution to not seek the death penalty, Jeffrey Munt agreed to testify at Joey Banas' trial. On February 15, 2013, jury selection for Banas' trial began. During the jury selection process, jurors were asked, "Do you have anything against homosexual orientation?" Many jurors had offensive answers to that question. "You might be born that way, but you don't have to act on it," one said. A jury was finally seated, and the trial of Joseph Banas began on February 26, 2013, now almost 3 years after the 911 call that set all of this off. The prosecutor gave a rundown of Jamie Carroll's life, but only the bad parts. You wouldn't really think he was talking about a victim. Quote, "It took 6 months to find Jamie because Jamie Carroll was the kind of guy that no one would miss. And Jeffrey Munt and Joey Banas knew this fact. He'd been in trouble most of his life, most of which were drug-related charges." He explained that Jamie was due to go to prison and wanted to spend his last days partying, and quote, "Who better to party with than Jeffrey Munt and Joey Banas?" He said, "They smoked meth and engaged in group sex. Then they ran out of meth, so Jamie left to go get more from his motel room. And that's when Jeffrey and Joey began to plot." He painted a kinky and gruesome scene. All men were naked, engaging in group sex. Quote, "And at this point, the party is over for Jamie Carroll, because the last thing that Jamie Carroll will ever remember is lying naked on that bed as he is stabbed and shot numerous times to his death." Prosecutor Josh Schneider closed, explaining up front to the jurors that they would hear from Jeffrey Munt, and said that he had entered an agreement with them to avoid the death penalty, and they had to make up their own minds about what happened. Defense attorney Justin Brown said Banas was innocent of the, quote, "brutal and senseless and horrific stabbing and shooting of James Carroll." Frankly, that is the type of strong wording you would usually expect to hear from the prosecution. Brown admitted that Joey Banas tampered with evidence and that he helped move and bury Jamie's body. Quote, "Yes, he did those things and those actions. They do haunt him every day." But then he pointed out that it was Joey who had told the police about the body in the first place and how he was insistent to speak to someone in homicide. He gave the police Jamie Carroll's name, and he told them where to find the gun Jeffrey had used. Brown told Joey's side of the story, including that Jeffrey Munt had felt left out and ignored when they were all in bed together that night. Brown also promised that Joey would testify, which was a mistake. But he did acknowledge that feelings of shock and disgust were natural, but as jurors, they needed to put that aside. After opening statements, the detectives, coroners, and officers on the scene all testified, and Joey's recorded police interview was played. And then Jeffrey Munt testified. And I am going to have to summarize a lot of this. He was on the stand for a very long time, both on direct examination and then on cross. And all I can say for sure is that both sides, the prosecution and defense, set out to show just how kinky or depraved both men were. Jeffrey explained his relationship with Joey, insisting that he had only started doing drugs after he met Joey. He said they spent about $500 a day on meth. Joey had money from a supposed bank robbery, and Jeffrey was using his savings. He was laid off in January, after the murder, and from that point on, he used counterfeit money to get by. When the prosecutor, Josh Schneider, asked him to explain tops and bottoms, he calmly complied, but went further, saying you could be an active top or an active bottom. Basically, he was saying neither position really indicated who was in control. Jeffrey was asked if he ever worked for the U.S. government and if he ever killed 35 people. He said no. And when they asked, what if Joey Banas said that he did, Jeffrey said it was just role play. Quote, "You let your sexual fantasies run wild. It adds interest to the sex. In that scene, Joey was the criminal and I was the government agent." The prosecutor asked, "Did you wear costumes? Did he wear costumes?" Jeffrey said, yes, I happen to be into rubber, latex, and vinyl. Things that are tight and shiny. It's just one of the fetishes I have. Spandex. He then described the night of Jamie Carroll's murder. Very dispassionately, clinically. We were playing with each other, he said. We were jacking off. Meth makes me intensely focused and very sexual. He meant him and Joey. And then he said Jamie approached the bed and he assumed they were all going to have sex together, but he felt a sudden jerk and was thrown off the bed and hit his head on the bedside table. He claimed he didn't know what was going on, but that Jamie started screaming, no, Joey, please no, and that they were struggling on the bed. Quote, I was still thinking this was some type of sex scene that was going on, you know, sort of typical. Well, I don't know about typical, but yes, a sort of sex scene you would invent. This was his second day of testimony. Now under direct examination by prosecutor Ryan Conroy, who said, I don't understand. What do you mean? And Jeffrey said, well, I mean, this is part of the fantasy world of sex, where, you know, you use sex as release. The best example I can come up with is a heterosexual couple, maybe into, you know, the naughty nurse and the patient, or the naughty nurse and the doctor. He went on to explain that he had been hit pretty hard in the head, but eventually he realized, quote, Joey had a knife and was slicing Jamie's throat. Please note here that the medical examiner said that Jamie Carroll's throat had not been sliced. He had been stabbed in a downward motion in the neck. So honestly, you could look at this two ways. Jeffrey really didn't stab Jamie and just saw all the blood in that area and assumed. Or he is lying on purpose, making it seem like he didn't see exactly where Jamie was stabbed. The prosecutor stopped him and said, okay, diagram this out. Jeffrey said Joey's knife was on the chest of drawers. He said, quote, you could actually smell the blood. Remember, we were all naked. Then he described Joey Banas shooting Jamie Carroll. He said Jamie's head was facing him when he was shot. Quote, his head was just lolling about. Something on his neck had been cut. If he is lying, he is good. He said Joey gave him two choices, help or be killed. He then said he was so upset and still so high on meth that Joey gave him GHB to calm down and made him help move Jamie's body. He then said Joey locked him in the cellar with the body so he couldn't call anyone while he went to go get the supplies to bury the body, which is not what he originally told police. Prosecutor Conroy showed him a photo of him and Joey posing and smiling in front of a Christmas tree and asked if it was after the murder, and Jeffrey said yes. For some reason, Ryan Conroy felt the need to revisit their entire relationship, how they met, what they were into, and then she again asked him to explain tops and bottoms. This time, Jeffrey was explicit. Quote, top is the one who's considered anally penetrative, basically the man who fucks the other guy, and the bottom would be the one who's receiving that penetration. Then she asked if it was the same as dominant and passive, and Jeffrey said no, patiently explaining that again. I actually went back and read all the court notes for myself to see why they kept coming back to this topic. It would seem from conversations at the bench that they were trying to establish who was the dominant partner, and therefore who was probably the murderer. I think that's why Jeffrey went into so much detail about how bottoms can be dominant, because there are sex tapes shown later, and Jeffrey is on top and is role-playing as dominant. And on the stand, Jeffrey explained his enjoyment of role-playing under even more questions from the prosecution and finally said, quote, I don't know how to relate to you or the jury, quite frankly, ma'am. Now they finally got to the night of the 911 call. Jeffrey told his version of what happened on the night of June 17, 2010. He said that Joey found out he was going to the police about Jamie. He said he must have seen text messages or overheard a phone call. He said Joey confronted him, and Jeffrey said yes, he was going to the police. And that's when Joey started chasing him through the house. So he barricaded himself in the bedroom and called 911. When he asked why he planned to go to the police, he said, quote, I had just had enough. I couldn't live with the guilt of what had happened, and I just couldn't live with the violence that was being inflicted on me on a daily basis. When defense attorney Justin Brown rose for his cross-examination, he asked a lot of the same explicit questions. What do you like sexually? He asked. This time Jeffrey mentioned mummification. Effectively, it means basically being covered in rubber or fully enclosed in some type of constraining environment. It's the same thing that I like in bondage, he said. Brown asked Jeffrey about Joey Banas being constrained in a box during sex. Jeffrey said there was no connection between mummification and Jamie Carroll being put into the container. Okay, this part I understand, but Jeffrey just offered mummification as one of his kinks, so he basically walked into this. Jeffrey also made a comment out of nowhere about Joey being HIV positive and not telling him about it. Eventually, he said Joey used his HIV positive status as a weapon to terrorize him. But Justin Brown reminded him that there were videos of him and Joey having unprotected sex. And on a side note, when officers were searching the house, they found plastic baggies with milky, viscous fluid and asked Jeffrey what it was. Well, it was their semen. They saved it and used it for lubricant. Sorry to be so explicit, but he was trying to act as though Joey's HIV status was weaponized against him. He clearly didn't care. And it was found on his dating websites that basically he was down to bareback. An acronym was explained, meaning he didn't care about someone's HIV status. Banas' other defense attorney, Darren Wolf, exhaustively went through home movies, text messages, and all kinds of things to impeach Jeffrey's testimony. One was a text where Joey had apologized to Jeffrey for failing him and calls him my sweet. Then he had typed, quote, Jace, I love you, but I hear too many footsteps. Please do not involve any officials. I will inform them of the basement if you do. Darren Wolf said this was Joey threatening to go to the police about Jamie's murder. But Jeffrey denied this and said it was evidence of Joey lying. Wolf said, quote, so if you went to the police about some other issue, he would tell them about the body in the basement? Jeffrey said no. This was text number 60 read in court, and it was not the last, if that gives you an idea of the sheer volume of evidence entered, evidence that a lot of times could really be read both ways. One interesting witness was one of Jeffrey Munt's former co-workers, Libby Davis. She said Jeffrey Munt had been jolly, assertive, and sure of himself. She said she often saw him with a lot of cash. She had been to lunch with him a few times and had been to his house for a New Year's Eve party. This established how well she knew him. She said that after she saw a news report about Munt being arrested, she contacted police about something she saw. Libby said that in mid-December of 2009, she noticed fresh scratches on Munt's neck. She said they looked as though someone had scratched you really, really hard. Munt told Libby he fell off a boat dock. Libby said that after she saw the news report, quote, I got instantly sick because I knew where those scratches came from. Finally, the defense rested. Joey Banas never testified. After seeing the grilling that Jeffrey got as a witness for the state, you can imagine what he was facing on cross-examination from the prosecution. But as the saying goes with lawyers, never promise more than you can produce. On March 8, 2013, Joseph Banas was found guilty of complicity to murder, complicity to first-degree robbery, complicity to tampering with evidence, complicity to first-degree criminal possession of a forged instrument, 3 counts of possession of methamphetamine, and possession of drug paraphernalia. The jury had deliberated for around 9 hours. After the trial, David Domine got an email from a juror. She explained that the attorneys told her after the trial that Joey Banas didn't testify because if he did, the prosecution would play a very damning video they had of him. This video would be shown in Jeffrey's trial. After Banas was found guilty, he waived the jury sentencing phase. On March 13th, he reached a deal with the prosecution which would take the death penalty off the table. As part of the deal, Banas agreed to testify at Munt's trial. Joey would not be sentenced until after Jeffrey's trial. The jury selection for Jeffrey Munt's trial was pretty much the same, except this time there was no lengthy and graphic questions about discomfort with gay sex. Opening statements began on May 15, 2013. The prosecution's opening statement was pretty much the same as it was in Banas' trial, except this time they added in Joey Banas' 5 previous felony convictions. Then the prosecutor said, that's the kind of guy Banas is, and who is Munt? Well, Munt is an extremely intelligent individual. Munt, for a period of his life while he was with Banas, was addicted to meth. And Munt is a liar. He is an absolute liar. There is no doubt about that. He spent most of his professional life as an IT guy with computers working at pretty prestigious universities. He's well-spoken. He's a bright guy. Prosecution's theory was that Jeffrey Munt actively planned and committed the murder and robbery. The prosecution used text messages between Joey and Jeffrey to prove that their, quote, relationship was not based on fear as Jeffrey had contended. The prosecution also introduced a video of Joey and Jeffrey engaging in sexual acts, with Jeffrey being the dominant one, as well as a photo of Jeffrey wearing a latex shirt to prove the same thing. Jeffrey Munt was represented by prominent Louisville defense attorney Stephen Romines. The defense's opening statement was 1 hour and 46 minutes. It was long and insane. In fact, the judge interjected and said, "This opening has been extremely argumentative and long. Wrap things up. The jury's uncomfortable. I'm uncomfortable. This has been way too long." Stephen Romine's opening statement included a lot of details from Jeffrey's testimony at Joey's trial. Andy played the video I told you about. In the video, Joey says he's going to commit suicide if his boyfriend doesn't stop him. He shows that he's holding a gun and then moves the camera to Jeffrey, who is sitting on the bed just looking at a laptop computer. And then he goes on to say, basically, he bequeaths all he has to Jeffrey and seemingly confesses, quote, "I'm here to state that any property belonging to myself as well as any funds forwarded to my estate through my part in the lawsuit involving the club go to Jace. I specifically name him. I am in love with him and consider him my lifelong partner, and it is my will that he be the beneficiary. I am holding him hostage because I have failed him and hurt him and done terrible things which I can never recover from. This includes killing," and then there's a long pause, "someone who," and another long pause, "this includes killing someone." Remember, we are only in opening statements here. Romine said Joey Banas was a psychopath who targeted Jeffrey. He said Joey Banas was a felon, meth junkie, drug dealer, and someone who would have unprotected sex with people to infect them with HIV. The defense said, quote, "Joey Banas is a monster, and Jeff Munt was his prey." Romine said in November of 2009, Jeffrey was making $250,000 a year at the University of Louisville. A month later, Jamie Carroll was robbed of $700 and killed. Why would Jeffrey Munt do that? He had a good job, a nice car, and a house. He also said when Joey Banas found out Jamie Carroll was going to prison in December 2009, Joey said he wanted to take over Jamie's drug dealing business. The defense said that the killing happened on December 15, 2009. 2 days later, Jamie Carroll was heading off to jail. Joey and Jamie were supposed to finalize their deal that night, but Jamie backed out. And defense attorney Stephen Romine said, "You don't double-cross Joey Banas." The basic defense was that Jeffrey Munt was an innocent bystander. The defense said that after killing Jamie, Joey drugged Jeffrey with GHB and said, quote, "You say one fucking word and I will blow your head off. I know where your parents live and I will go there also." Romines also said Jeffrey was terrorized by Joey and that he lived in fear of him. Joey followed Jeffrey with GPS, beat him, monitored his phone, and started taking him to and from work every day to keep tabs on him. The defense had LaTanya Jones with the Kentucky Domestic Association testify that Jeffrey Munt was a battered spouse. Joey Banas tried to rescind his deal with the prosecution. He actually went back and forth so many times it's ridiculous, and I don't know why. After watching Jeffrey testify against him, you would think he would be ready for vindication. But maybe he remembered how long and arduous Jeffrey's testimony and cross had been. But he did testify. He told the same story he told to the police. He said that at first, he thought killing Jamie was over robbery, but now he thought it was over jealousy. Joey said that as they cleaned the bedroom after the murder, Jeffrey removed SIM cards and got rid of Jamie's devices so they couldn't be traced. And again mentioned that he thought Jeffrey had done this before. And Jeffrey Munt did not testify in his own defense. There had been some of the same witnesses, but for whatever reason, Joey was not exhaustively asked to explain his sex life. What position means what? Who was dominant? He did explain some shorthand on texts and emails like PNP means party and play. And they did, of course, show the graphic home movies. I'm not sure why it was different this time. Maybe they felt it didn't play that well in the first trial. Which, I don't know. Joey Banas was convicted of all charges. And in both trials, graphic photos of Jamie Carroll's corpse were shown. To me, that seems to be the most humanity they show the victim. by showing him in death the horror of it all. Otherwise, the prosecution really didn't mention the victim all that much. Jamie Carroll simply was lost in two trials that focused so much on drugs and kinky sex, and you would not believe how much detail I actually left out. On May 29th, Jeffrey Munt was acquitted of complicity to murder, but was found guilty of complicity to robbery and complicity to tampering with evidence. The jury deliberated for 8 hours. That same day, Jeffrey was sentenced to 8 years. On June 13, 2013, after testifying against Jeffrey Munt, Joey Banas was sentenced to life in prison without the possibility of parole for 20 years for the murder charge. With the other convictions, Joey Banas was given a total of 23 years. Because Jeffrey Munt had spent time in jail prior to his trial, he was immediately eligible for parole. However, he faced a warrant for his arrest in Chicago for fraud charges relating to the counterfeit bills and fake IDs found in the Hyatt hotel room. Haley put a note in her research that she could not find any trials for Munt after this. David Domine wrote the same thing in his book, except he actually went to Chicago for the first supposed trial date and discovered that Jeffrey wasn't on the docket. He asked the court clerk. There were no scheduled hearings or trials for Jeffrey Munt. He found it mysterious and creepy. He also said there were rumors that Jeffrey changed his name and moved out of the country, some said to Germany. There had been a photo of Jeffrey at trial in a rubber suit. One of his handles on a gay website was Gummikloss or Gummikloss, which means rubber cloths in German. Joey Banas is incarcerated in the Luther Locket Correctional Complex in Oldham County, Kentucky. His next parole eligibility date is June 2, 2030. After the trials were over, most people were still confounded. It was difficult to believe either man with full certainty, and most people were not happy with Jeffrey's light sentence. He was out free almost immediately after the trial. Prosecutor Ryan Conray told ABC7, quote, "Jeffrey Munt was living this life where he was doing drugs, he was counterfeiting money, he was participating in the killing of another individual. As sick as it sounds, I think he was thrilled and loved every minute of that crazy ride." The other prosecutor, Josh Snyder, said both of them, Munt and Banas, were the two most diabolical, intelligent individuals I have ever met. Jeffrey Munt's attorney, Steve Romines, said, "Jeff Munt, for his entire life, had been a law-abiding, very successful person. He meets Joey Banas one night, and 9 weeks later, he's got a body in his basement. He was targeted by Joey Banas. Joey was just a psychopath." The prosecution team and investigators all believed that Jeffrey got away with murder. Defense attorney Stephen Romines clapped back with, "They're wrong, and they need to get out of this business if that's what they say. The jury found him not guilty of murder, and if they believe he got away with murder, they should do their jobs better." I would argue that Romines was exceptional at his job. He was compared to fictional attorney Ben Matlock because of his southern drawl, but also his effectiveness. David Domine talked to one ex-prosecutor who said, quote, "A lot of lawyers who have a lot of charisma rely solely on that. And a lot of lawyers without charisma try to compensate by preparing to death. The thing that makes Steve so tough is he does both." I love this quote. It reminds me of Racehorse Haynes. And Stephen Romines certainly seemed to run that second trial. With an almost 2-hour opening statement, he never let up. And his clapback about prosecutors doing their jobs better also put a grin on my face. I do love a good slap fight in the press. And you'll notice, prosecutors changed their strategy when they tried Jeffrey Munt. There was kink-shaming, but nothing like in the first trial. I wonder if they thought Romines would continuously object, trying to get that line of questioning thrown out, because I would have if I was his lawyer. I cannot believe how long and detailed it was allowed to be in the first trial. It was like Justin Brown, Joey's attorney, let it in because it made Jeffrey look bad, not necessarily Joey. But I think that backfired on him. Joey Banas's father, the plastic surgeon, had hired Justin Brown, also known as a top dog. I think he did his job well. He may have lacked that folksy persona that hides the sharp focus like Romines had. And it would seem his hands were tied about Joey testifying. And to be honest, I don't know what to make of that video. It doesn't necessarily seem like a smoking gun to me. Jeffrey, as seen in the video, doesn't seem scared. He seems disinterested. Maybe Joey was trying to scare him by saying he would kill himself. Maybe Jeffrey forced Joey to make the video. We aren't given a lot of context about the video, so it is really strange. Either way, I just don't know. There are so many things about Jeffrey Munt that are mysterious. Detective John Lesher wouldn't even discuss the CIA rumors with David Domine for his book. Why didn't Jeffrey Munt face trial in Chicago? Fraud pertaining to counterfeit money isn't exactly a traffic ticket. Where the hell did he go? And really, what happened the night of that 911 call? These men had kept their secret for 6 months. I heard part of the call, found it on a YouTube video. Jeffrey does sound scared, and David thought so too when it was played in court. But if anything, Jeffrey really comes off more as the dominant one, not just sexually, it was in his manner, he seemed more controlled, and it was his gun. Joey said that Jeffrey was jealous. Jealousy actually makes much more sense as a motive. Jeffrey didn't need the money, as his attorney pointed out. Maybe they were so strung out on meth that they just wanted to steal his drugs and things got out of hand. Maybe one had the knife and one had the gun, and someone lost control. Something else occurred to me as this case has swirled in my head. What if the whole fight that night of the 911 call had been about Jamie Carroll? It may have started about something else, but then they both threatened to tell the police and accuse each other. You have to know it was something they could hold over each other's heads. Both of them offered it up out of nowhere to police officers who had separated them. Joey did first, and he was insistent about talking to Homicide. He was truthful in everything he said. Jeffrey blurted it out and then later denied knowledge and feigned surprise and horror that there was a body in his basement. I really wish they had gotten the same sentence, because I don't think there is any way to prove who really did it. But what is really sad to me is that Jamie Carroll is lost in all this scandal and intrigue. He was a human being. He deserved more than to be buried in an old wine cellar and forgotten about. Even after his body was found, he was not really the focus of the story, not in the press and not really in court. A gay man with a drug problem isn't a sexy leading story. And yet, a gay love triangle with kinky sex and drugs is. Jamie was laid to rest in Halbert Cemetery in the small community of Printer, Kentucky. Jamie Carroll does have family who grieve for him and friends who remember him as a sweet kid. He mattered. The old Robinson house was eventually bought and renovated in December 2011, 2 years after Jamie's murder and before Joey and Jeffrey even went to trial. The new owners told the press that they had the basement where Jamie had been buried spiritually cleansed, and then they had the dirt floor paved over. But in a house like 1435 South 4th Street, with so much dark history, do you really think it can ever be cleansed of that much pain and suffering? Southern Fried True Crime is written, hosted, and produced by me, Erica Kelly. Southern Fried's original music is by Rob Harrison of Gamma Radio, and the original graphic art is by Coley Horner. Thank you to author and old Louisville expert, David Domine, for generously offering his book and his court notes for this episode. A Dark Room in Glitterball City is out everywhere now. I also recommend David's volumes on the ghosts of old Louisville, as well as his cookbooks. David is a man of extraordinary talents, and I cannot thank him enough for collaborating with me on this episode. Thanks also and always to Haley Gray for her impeccable research. Again, she kept me straight with all the trial facts while I got to lose myself in old Louisville with David. Don't forget to come and find our new Facebook group. Search for Southern Fried True Crime Fans Discussion Group. We still worship our patron saint, Dolly Parton, share fun memes and delicious recipes. Our group is a safe and fun corner of Facebook, and by God, we mean it when we say no shit ass is allowed. It's not just a motto, it's how we run the group. Please submit case suggestions to southernfriedtruecrime@gmail.com. I do not accept suggestions on social media, and I apologize if I am unable to answer your email. I get dozens of suggestions a week, and it takes time to go through and check out each case. I will definitely contact you if I plan to use the case you submit to see if you would like to be credited on the episode. Thank you all so much for sending in these suggestions. I truly get my most interesting cases from listener suggestions, so keep them coming. If you enjoyed today's show, don't forget to subscribe and please tell a friend or rate and review on iTunes. I'm also on most large platforms like iHeart, Stitcher, and Spotify, as well as Stitcher Premium, where you can listen ad-free. Until next time, thanks so much for listening. Y'all take care.